for argument is Engel versus Foley and Lardner. Mr. McGinnis.
May it please the court, John McGinnis on behalf of Clyde Engel, who seeks reversal of two judgments entered by the district court below without federal subject matter jurisdiction. Foley and Lardner, which was not a party to the case below, claims that the district court had jurisdiction over its dispute with Clyde Engel based upon the district court's retained ancillary jurisdiction over a settlement agreement between the plaintiff below and the defendants below. There are three reasons why this ancillary jurisdiction fails. First, the underlying case was dismissed with prejudice prior to Foley and Lardner bringing its motion for confession of judgment. This dismissal with prejudice deprived the district court of any further jurisdiction in the case, and it had no jurisdiction then to entertain Foley and Lardner's motion in the case. Secondly, if the district court did retain any jurisdiction, it did not retain jurisdiction over Foley and Lardner, which was not a party to the case. The district court could only retain jurisdiction over parties to the case. And third, if the court did retain jurisdiction after the dismissal with prejudice, it retained jurisdiction over the settlement agreement between the parties, which was a specific document. The master payment agreement under which Foley and Lardner brought suit was not retained. The jurisdiction was not retained over that by the district court. The operative order is the February 5th, 2004 order of dismissal by the district court. That order was originally a dismissal without prejudice and retained jurisdiction over the settlement agreement between the parties. When
the district court in that order says that after the steps are taken, that the action shall be with prejudice and without leave to reinstate, then in the next paragraph says the court will retain jurisdiction to enforce the terms of the settlement. Why shouldn't we read those two paragraphs as having been entered by the district court contemporaneously, and we have to read them together?
Your Honor, you have to read them together, but you don't have to read them temporally. What the district court was saying is that it was retaining jurisdiction over the dispute between the parties while the case was dismissed without prejudice. And that was entirely proper. When the case became a dismissal with prejudice, the district court lost jurisdiction.
Interestingly enough, that doesn't seem to be the district judge's view, though, does it?
No, that clearly is not the district judge's view, Your Honor.
The district judge wrote this.
The district judge wrote this, and the district judge also entered judgment for Foley and Lardner. But my contention is, Your Honor, that the district judge and several other district judges, which Foley and Lardner cite in their brief, simply are not following the dictates of this court in Lynch versus Sumata Mason.
Well, if a district court wants to end an institutional litigation or class action litigation, any type of a thing where there's a settlement agreement, but does not want the parties to be able to commence the case again, either in that court or in any other court, how would the district court explain itself other than this?
Your Honor, if the district court wants to retain jurisdiction over a settlement agreement, it can dismiss the case without prejudice and retain jurisdiction over the settlement agreement. A party could not then bring another action because the party bringing the other action would be in violation of the settlement agreement, which would be the very reason why the district court was retaining jurisdiction.
Am I correct? For you to prevail today, we have to accept the fact that paragraphs 7 and 8 read together do not convey that thought.
Your Honor, what we have to read is that those paragraphs are not read temporally. Those paragraphs simply state that the district court was retaining jurisdiction. It was entirely proper for the district court to retain jurisdiction while the case was dismissed without prejudice.
Well, had the case been settled at that point?
Your Honor, the case there had been a settlement agreement reached at that point, but that settlement agreement had various steps which need to be, which had to be undertaken before the settlement agreement was finalized.
It hadn't been fulfilled, had it?
It hadn't been fulfilled. That's why the case was dismissed without prejudice, because the district court specifically said...
Wouldn't it have made a lot more sense for the district judge to have done nothing until the case was settled and then enter a final judgment with prejudice?
That probably would have made more sense, Your Honor.
Why did she want to dismiss it when it hadn't been settled yet?
Your Honor, I was...
That's what's so strange.
I was not...
Wouldn't that answer Judge Ripple's question that if she waited until the steps required in the settlement were taken and then entered a final judgment, then res judicata would attach and there wouldn't be any problem?
That probably would have made more sense, Your Honor, but we still would be at the exact same place, because the district court judge believed that even though she dismissed the case with prejudice, she still retained jurisdiction.
Didn't she specifically say that?
Well, Your Honor, bear in mind that what happened here is on January 28, 2005, the dismissal became one with prejudice. The district court judge then, when Foley and Lardner brought its motion for confession of judgment in July and then its second motion in October, entertained those motions, thereby believing that she still retained jurisdiction over the settlement agreement, even though the case had been dismissed with prejudice 7 months earlier.
Is there any reference in the settlement agreement to attorney's fees?
No, there's not, Your Honor. But again, what we have to determine is what the settlement agreement is. It is our position that the settlement agreement, over which the district court could have retained jurisdiction until the case had been dismissed with prejudice, was the settlement agreement between the parties. Foley and Lardner argues that what the district court sought to retain jurisdiction over was a broad settlement. And an affidavit in the record from Foley and Lardner states that this broad settlement contained 26 separate agreements, and that the district court sub silencio was retaining jurisdiction over 25 unnamed agreements, even though the record only says that she was retaining jurisdiction over the settlement agreement and release, Your Honor. And that, again, the district court could not retain jurisdiction over unnamed agreements.
Well, was the entry of judgment with prejudice proper when all of the elements were not fulfilled in the settlement?
Your Honor, the entry of judgment with prejudice would be proper, because if...
How can you enter judgment if all of the elements are not fulfilled as of that date?
Well, Your Honor, the district court was not entering judgment. What the district court was doing was dismissing the case with prejudice.
Well, that's a judgment, isn't it?
But there... Well, Your Honor,
that's
there...
That's a judgment. And how do you enter judgment if all of the... If all of the elements of the contract are not fulfilled?
Your Honor, there are numerous cases of this court and other courts which state that you can have a settlement agreement and a dismissal with prejudice, and that settlement agreement then is an independent contract. And if that independent contract is breached, you have your remedy in state court. The mere fact that you are in federal court under some jurisdictional aegis does not mutate that contract into federal jurisdiction. You have your contractual remedies under the settlement agreement. If the settlement agreement is breached, your action is in state court. In fact, that's what the dicta of Lynch versus Samada Mason and Jessup versus Luther state. You should go to state court.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McGinnis.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Karen?
May it please the court. I was admitted to practice before this court on January 13, 1956. Therefore, this is my 50th anniversary.
Congratulations.
The question before the panel is whether this is an appropriate case for the application of the doctrine of ancillary jurisdiction. There have been many...
I don't understand that. I thought the theory was that somehow this fee agreement of yours was part of the settlement.
That's correct.
I wasn't part of the settlement.
Yes, it was.
No, it wasn't. It was not referred to in the settlement. It's a separate contract between a party and a non-party.
Well, the documents were all interrelated, Your Honor. You couldn't get.
No, they're not interrelated. There are all sorts of incidental disputes that can arise out of a litigation. You could have a contract with a stenographic service, with a computer service, with what have you. They don't all get swept into federal jurisdiction. I don't get that.
No, it has to be. It has to be related closely enough.
No, but everything is related to everything else, right? I mean,
but they aren't all necessarily close enough to
yeah,
justify.
Yeah, but that's
it.
So mushy. I mean, ordinarily, ancillary jurisdiction very narrowly construed would be a case where a plaintiff wins a case and has a right to attorney's fees, a statutory right. That would be standard ancillary jurisdiction to resolve that. And similarly, an award of costs. But to have a separate contract between a party and his lawyer brought into federal jurisdiction, that's I don't see any basis for that, any precedent for that.
Well, resolution of fee disputes is cited as one of the classical examples for the invoking of the ancillary jurisdiction doctrine.
Yes, but those are disputes when a party has a statutory right to fees and is seeking fees from the other party to the litigation. Not in a situation where a law firm gets into a dispute with a party.
Well,
and there's no reference to their contract in the settlement agreement. I've never seen that before.
Well, I'll read a.
You could have put it into the settlement. You could say this settlement is not final until Foley and Lardner is paid, something of that sort, but that isn't there either.
Well, there's a recitation in the fee agreement itself that it is being executed to facilitate the settlement of the underlying dispute. That appears in two separate.
But the dispute had been settled; a final judgment had been entered. There was no need to bring this back before the district judge. Not only that, nothing in the case has to do with your dispute with Engel, right? He just doesn't pay. So he's not accusing you of malpractice, right?
So far.
Well.
For example, the statement made in Abbott Laboratories versus CVS Pharmacy, where the opinion states, Abbott observes that the supplemental jurisdiction sometimes allows the resolution of disputes that are closely related to the original litigation. Controversies about attorney's fees for work in the underlying suit are prime examples. Now, Your Honor, you're saying that the reference there to attorney's fee disputes is confined to petitions for fees, things that arise directly out of the award of fees and costs and so forth.
Correct.
That's what you're saying. The opinion goes on to state, ever since 28 U.S.C. 1367 overturned Finley versus the United States, the supplemental jurisdiction has been capacious enough to include claims by or against third parties. Your Honor, it seems your view of this.
Yes, but look, a standard such case would be I sue you, and now you bring in a third party that you say has promised to indemnify you. That'd be standard ancillary jurisdiction. But Foley and Lardner has never been made a party to this litigation.
No. No, but I don't read or understand the cases to say that ancillary jurisdiction should be that narrowly construed when the cases talk about it, including claims by or against third parties. My understanding, Your Honor, is what you're saying is you're really confining that type of thing to indemnification obligations and so forth.
Suppose that 2 years after this case had been resolved, you contended that the stenographic services company that you had hired to provide you with daily transcript had overcharged you. Could you bring that claim back to the federal district judge 2 years after the case had been resolved?
Well, I don't think
on the ground that was an ancillary dispute.
I don't think it's closely enough related to the original action.
Well, how is it different here? Instead of having an argument with a stenographic service, Engel has an argument with his lawyer. But it's after the case has been dismissed with prejudice. So I should think that would be the termination. Once dismissed with prejudice, all subsequent disputes have to find their own jurisdictional foundation somewhere.
Well, the cases that appear to recognize the right to retain jurisdiction to enforce a settlement, even though there's been a dismissal with prejudice, seem to honor the district judge's intent. The language that jurisdiction is being reserved to enforce trumps any language in the order that recites a dismissal with prejudice. There seems to be some effort on the part of the
Well, even if that's so, that's to enforce the settlement, and this is not part of the settlement.
Well, if you start from that premise that it's not part of the settlement, I agree. At that point, I have a difficult position to uphold. I just feel that factually what occurred here makes all this part of the settlement, because the need to release the liens on all these various pieces of property so that the settlement could be consummated was an integral part of the whole exercise.
Then why isn't it referred to in the settlement, that the settlement doesn't take effect until the liens are removed?
Probably sloppy draftsmanship.
I'm sorry? I didn't hear.
Probably sloppy draftsmanship.
Sloppy drafting, okay.
I think those are the issues that the court must address. What constitutes the settlement? What's the legal effect of the dismissal with prejudice? And I think in our discussion we have addressed them. The settlement that did take place, we submit, is one that can be enforced through the doctrine of ancillary jurisdiction, and we would ask that the court affirm the district court in this respect.
Thank you, Mr. Caron. Mr. McGinnis, how much time does he have? 1 minute? Mm-hmm.
Like I have 1 minute, Your Honor. Briefly, the settlement agreement and release was a specific document, the master payment agreement under which Foley seeks its judgment is a separate document. These are not the master payment agreement is not a petition for attorney's fees. Foley never petitioned the district court for attorney's fees. It sought confession of judgment under a contract. This contract has to find its own independent means for federal jurisdiction. This is not a case for attorney's fees. And secondly, Your Honor, the fact that liens may have had to have been released by Foley and Lardner is merely a condition precedent. It is not part of the settlement agreement and release, which was the specific document. And as Your Honor pointed out, the master payment agreement was never referenced in the settlement agreement and release. The master payment agreement was never referenced by the district court in any of its in its dismissal order dismissing the case. So for that reason, Your Honor, there was no retained jurisdiction over the master payment agreement, and there was no jurisdiction for the district court to entertain Foley and Lardner's motion for confession of judgment. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. McGinnis and Mr. Perrin. Next case.